Well, I think we probably all know that December is for a great number of people the happiest and perhaps the most exciting time of year. For most, it is also the busiest and the most hectic time of year. With all the presents to buy and the parties to attend, cookies to bake, often the true meaning of Christmas is easily lost. Many of us get so busy doing the things that people of our day and time do at Christmas that we don't have time, nor can we find the energy to simply pause and experience the simple, uncomplicated joy of celebrating the coming of the God-child who brings us peace. Today's story is about one family who lived their lives in another time and in a simple manner that allowed just such a time as we often miss. And let me just say aside, many people in this congregation I knew grew up on farms, and you might relate to this family because this is about a story about a family in 1935 who were farmers. They happened to be Mennonites, but they were farmers nonetheless. It is also, the title of this is called The Christmas Gift. And I wrote the story, but I included a story written by a man by the name of Paul Flueckey. And I think you will see where his story begins as mine ends off. It was well into December, only 3 days before Christmas, and three winter storms had already blown in from the northeast and blanketed the small town of Jonesboro and the surrounding hilly countryside with great drifts of powdery snow. Each storm in turn had brought life in these surrounds to a virtual standstill until the arduous task of digging out and clearing the roads was complete. Some roads, those lying farthest out away from town, might not be cleared for more than a week. But with each subsequent storm, the interval for the process took longer and longer. For the family of Jacob Mask, these frequent storms were almost welcome. His was one of the families far from the center of town, which meant that all summer and fall, their energies had been directed toward just such a time of year when they were forced to provide for themselves without benefit of any outside help. The year was 1935. The whole country was reeling and feeling the sting of the ongoing depression, and the Masks felt extremely blessed that there was no mortgage on their land. Many of their neighbors had already been forced through foreclosure and sheriff's auctions to leave their farms and light out for parts unknown. For the Masks, the opposite had happened. Jacob's two married daughters, Rachel and Leah, along with their husbands and children, had recently come home to the farm as there was no work for the men in the city where they lived. At the farm, there was plenty of food and enough wood to keep the house cozy, even on the coldest of nights. There was plenty of busy work, too, mostly in the form of chores and chopping firewood, but there was no real employment to generate money for the family. But six cows to feed and milk twice a day, pigs to feed and steers to tend to, kept the men of the household busy, not to mention two teams of workhorses that pretty well provided the motive power for the farming operation. Of course, there were also rabbits and chickens and a few turkeys, which the children looked after. By most standards, this extended family would be considered money poor. But Jacob and his wife Sarah knew the depth of their blessing and daily gave thanks in prayer for their good fortune. Sarah Mast was one of those women who found life as a homemaker and a caregiver to children, and now to grandchildren, completely satisfying. She was, what shall we say, plump and pleasingly so, with wispy chestnut hair, which was always neatly combed into a tight bun and tucked beneath her organdy prayer covering. Sarah and Jacob were Mennonites and lived in a community where many other Mennonite and Amish families lived. Their two sons were both married and lived and farmed within a mile of the home place, while their youngest daughter, Emily, was still living at home with her parents. For both Jacob and Sarah, it was a special blessing to have their two oldest daughters and their families living with them, even if it did try everyone's patience from time to time. Altogether, the house was now home to 13 souls, which I'm sure you can understand often put a strain on everyone's nerves. But for Jacob and Sarah, home was a place of life and hope, a place to nurture and hold children, a place to ensure posterity and success. You see, for most people in this community, the writings of King David the Psalmist best described how most Mennonites and Amish felt about family life. "Lo, children are an heritage of the Lord," said the psalmist, "and the fruit of the womb is the Lord's reward. As arrows are in the hand of a mighty man, so are the children of thy youth. Happy is one who has a quiver full of them." Into this sort of family atmosphere, then, it is shattering when a child dies. For Sarah and Jacob, such a tragedy struck early in their life together. Their first children, twin boys, were born in April of 1902. 7 months later, one of the twins, John, fell ill and died of pneumonia. The death had come within a week of the baby's first signs of illness, and neither of the parents expected that such a thing could happen so fast. Sarah often remembers the days of that tragedy. "We were just so young," she recalls, and deep within such a statement lay a veiled reference to her self-imposed guilt. As if they both might have been better equipped to handle the child's illness if they had been a little bit older, a little more prepared. Back then, they had just moved to this 100-acre farm at the northernmost end of the county. To cope with their loss, they both channeled their energies and their grief into the toil of everyday life on a farm, working out their sorrow in the soil which surrounded them. Over the next 10 years, they had three other children. One can only imagine the lingering apprehension Sarah and Jacob harbored when in 1918, an epidemic of influenza swept across the country and around the world. Before the epidemic subsided, millions had died, and deep within Sarah's heart, she half expected that her own children would soon fall victim to this incredible plague. But as the influenza departed, she found that none of her family had succumbed, and 20 years after little John had died, when she had been so young, Sarah gave birth to Emily. Over the years, Sarah had devoted herself to helping Jacob with the farm work, keeping house, and caring for her little ones. Despite the lingering guilt that sprang up whenever one of the children had so much as a runny nose or a sore throat, they were a happy family, a loving family. The farm was thriving, and as their children grew older, Sarah and Jacob were pleased beyond words that each of them were content and happy within the framework of the faith their parents had nurtured within them. As Christmas approached, there wasn't much change in their day-to-day lives. No Christmas trees or fancy decorations set this holiday apart from any other. There was no Santa Claus and no reindeer flying through the night sky to deliver toys from the North Pole. No, in a Mennonite household in 1935, Christmas was much different than what most of us would recognize today. Christmas was a time to consider just who this baby Jesus was and what his life would become. Certainly, it was a time of celebration, as each young adult in turn had placed their faith in the saving power of Jesus Christ and declared this faith at their baptism. They knew that they had outwardly committed their lives to following Jesus day by day in Christian discipleship. Christmas was a time for families to gather and share a special meal. Presents were exchanged as part of this celebration, especially for the young children, but most presents were homemade, especially during the Depression years like 1935. Sarah had been busy knitting mittens and scarves for her grandchildren, while Jacob often disappeared to his workshop in the barn after supper when he had been busy for weeks building simple wooden toys. In most Mennonite homes, Christmas was also a time centered around the beautiful music of the season and many joyous efforts to sing it in four-part harmony. When Jacob and Sarah's family had been youngsters, their youth group at church made an annual trip to the county nursing home to visit with the elderly and ask the residents what they wanted for Christmas. Some of the old people were too feeble to communicate, but a worker would often give them a list of things that they needed. Others were so excited just to have these young visitors, and they wanted to talk so much, it was hard for them to think about Christmas. Their wants were simple, almost childlike. "All I want is an apple pie," said one old woman. Others asked for bath powder and shaving lotion, socks, candy, a coffee mug, some puzzles, or maybe a mirror. On the following Sunday, the youngsters posted their list on the board at the meeting house, and by the next Sunday, all of the gifts had been purchased by the congregation. The following Saturday, there was a wrapping party, and then following the Sunday service just before Christmas, a second trip was made to the nursing home. Excitement built as the young people went from room to room to distribute the gifts to the residents. One old woman said, "I just don't believe this is for me. No one's given me a gift in a very long time." Others didn't talk or couldn't, but the youngsters could easily see there was a gleam in their eyes. During such activities, the young people learned much about the older people. In their get acquainted time, the youth learned that many of these elderly people had shared some of the same experiences that they were now having. They listened intently as the residents told their tales of the good old days. And after one of these annual visits, Jacob and Sarah's oldest son, David, said, "I met a guy in his 90s today, and you know what? I think he's a lot like me. He wasn't senile like most people think, just youthful like me." Rachel, the oldest daughter in the family, told a much sadder story. "I wonder why their children don't want them to be part of their families anymore. It's like putting an old bicycle away in a shed." In most Mennonite families, when aging grandparents became too old to care for themselves, it was quite rare for them to go to a nursing home. Most were cared for at the home of their children until they died. On the night before Christmas, gathered in the warmth of the massed family kitchen, which was bigger than the entire floor space of many smaller subdivision homes of today, the six newly arrived grandchildren played with their simple toys while Grandma Sarah and her three daughters were busy before the wood-fired stove, making preparations not only for supper, but also for their Christmas Day feast. Jacob and his two sons-in-law were in the barn milking cows and feeding the other animals. Now, this was normally work that Jacob could do himself, since he no longer had any boys at home to help. Sarah often helped, of course, and at 13, Emily was able to give a hand when needed. When Daniel, their youngest son, had married and began farming on his own, Jacob had sold many of their milk cows and kept only what he thought he could handle by himself. They sold cream, which they separated every other day, and the pigs got the benefit of the skim milk that was left. Since electricity had not yet come to the northern part of the county, there was also the daily chore of tending the oil lamps. When daylight was gone, the mass depended upon the light from the wick of kerosene lamps to help push back the darkness. Keeping these lamps filled, the wicks trimmed, and the chimneys cleaned was an ever-present task that more often than not fell to young Emily. She also helped to tend the two very hungry stoves in the house. She didn't mind carrying in wood and coal and corn cobs for the stoves at all. After all, the chore produced tangible results. Fuel for the living room stove helped to make cozy evenings, and fuel for the kitchen range translated into all the wonderfully delicious meals that Sarah coaxed from the old iron and nickel-plated marvel. It would be well after dark before the men once again returned to the warmth of the kitchen and a meal well weighted on the side of protein and starch and the ever-present cake or pie to finish. But before the meal would begin, there was always a mealtime blessing said by Jacob. Before an early bedtime, there would be some Bible reading and often a devotion, or even better, now that young children were once again in the house, a bedtime story from Papa. Over the years, Jacob had gained a reputation as a storyteller. When the children were very young, he told many a bedtime story. At first, he used easy-to-read children's books, but as the years went on, Jacob began to rely on his own abilities to imagine stories that had great appeal to his children. Even as they grew up, they still would beg him for a story, especially on special occasions when the family gathered together, like Christmas and Easter. This late December, with all its storms and six grandchildren living in the house, gave him a renewed opportunity to tell those stories. Some he remembered from days gone by, but the following story he told while the family gathered around the large wood burner in the front room on a night before Christmas as the wind howled and the snow blew outside. Jacob began. The story has been told for centuries now, how Gaspar, Melchior, and Balthazar brought gifts to the newborn king. Ah, you say, everyone knows this story. They brought gold and frankincense and myrrh, so it has been told. But the story as told is incomplete, Jacob said. Listen to the rest of it, and you shall learn the secrets of the gifts. Those who watched that night as the wise men arrived saw the first of the three visitors pause at the door of the stable. Gaspar was a wealthy man with a cloak of fine velvet trimmed in flawless fur. They could not see that it was the angel Gabriel guarding the holy place before whom Gaspar stopped. All who enter must bring a gift, Gabriel told the visitor. Struggling to lift a finely made box, Gaspar said, I have brought bars of the finest gold. Your gift, Gabriel said, must be something of the essence of yourself, something precious to your soul. Such have I brought, Gaspar said. But as he kneeled to lay his gold before the child, he stopped and stood erect. In his outstretched hand lay not gold, but a hammer. Its scarred and blackened head was larger than a man's fist. Its handle of hard wood was as long as a man's forearm. Gaspar stammered, dumbfounded. The angel said softly, What you hold in your hands is the hammer of your greed, used to pound wealth from those who labor so that you may live in luxury, used to build a mansion for yourself while others live in hovels. Gaspar bowed his head in shame and turned to leave, but Gabriel blocked the way. No, you have not offered your gift. Give this, Gaspar blurted in horror, not to a king. This is why you came, Gabriel said. You cannot take it back. It's too heavy. Leave it here or it will destroy you. Why, the child cannot lift it, Gaspar protested. He's the only one who can, Gaspar protested. Next to step to the door was Melchior, the scholar with the length of his beard and furrows of his brow to bespeak the wisdom of his age. He too paused before the door. What have you brought? Asked Gabriel. Frankincense, the fragrance of hidden lands in bygone days, Melchior replied. Your gift, cautioned Gabriel, must be something precious to your soul. Melchior stood breathless, kneeling reverently down to draw from beneath his robe a silver flask. But the vessel in his hand was not silver at all. It was common clay, tough and stained. Aghast, he pulled the stopper from its mouth and sniffed the contents. "This is vinegar," Melchior snarled. "You have brought what you are made of," Gabriel said. Bitterness, the soured wine of life, turned grim with jealousy and hate, carried within too long. The memory of old hurts, hoarded resentments, and smoldering anger. "You have sought knowledge, but have filled your life with poison." Melchior's shoulders drooped. Turning his face away, he fumbled to hide the earthen jar. Gabriel touched Melchior's arm. "Wait, you must leave your gift." Melchior sighed with pain deep within. "But this is vile stuff," he protested. "What if the child should touch it to his lips?" "You must leave that worry to heaven," Gabriel replied. "There is use even for vinegar." One more visitor strode toward Balthazar, the leader of many legions and the scourge of walled cities. He grasped the brass-bound box. "I bring myrrh," he said, "the most precious booty of my boldest conquest. Many have fought and died for such as this, the essence of a most rare herb." "But is this the essence of yourself?" Gabriel asked. The soldier shuffled forward, bowing his head near the ground and releasing his grip on the handle of the box. But what he laid before the baby's feet was his own spear. "It cannot be," he whispered hoarsely. "Some enemy has cast a spell." "That is more true than you know," Gabriel said from behind. "A thousand enemies have cast their spell on you and turned your soul into a spear. Living only to conquer, you have been conquered. Each battle you win leads only to another." Balthazar grasped the weapon and turned to the door. "I cannot leave this." "Are you sure?" Gabriel asked. "But here," the warrior whispered, "he is but a child. The spear could pierce his flesh." "That fear you must leave to heaven," Gabriel replied. "Now, what of these gifts, you may ask? The hammer, the vinegar, and the spear. You know, there's another story that says they were seen once more, years later, on a lonely hillside outside the city of Jerusalem. But don't worry, that is a burden heaven itself took care of, as only heaven can. That story, in all its simplicity, was Jacob's gift to his grandchildren. Sure, there would be some toys and mittens and scarves in the morning, but telling stories that encouraged each member of this quiet, hard-working family to walk in the footsteps of the baby whose birth they would celebrate tomorrow was for him a greater gift than anything he could have made or bought in a store. When Jacob had finished this story, the children were almost asleep, and within minutes their parents had tucked them deeply beneath the homemade quilts and eiderdowns that covered their beds. By morning, it would be cold in the upstairs bedrooms, and the bed covers would be a place to cuddle and linger as long as they could. The two youngest children slept in the same room as their respective parents, while the others shared a room with two large brass beds. The walls were bare of ornament, and simple curtains hung at the windows. But this was a home filled with love, and each of these children that loved and considered the big farmhouse of Grandma and Papa's to be their own home. In our day, it so often seems that time is more precious than money. While we are often willing to spend small fortunes on our children and grandchildren at Christmas, we emulate Scrooge when it comes to sharing our time with them. Our little ones deserve our love, but they also need to know that God loves them too. Christmas is that time of year when we realize just how very far his love for us, or how very much his love for us cost him. for that little baby born in the manger in Bethlehem would soon enough become the Savior of the world.